The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 18th of September 2020 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's programme, the WHO's Europe chief warns governments not to relax quarantines as recorded COVID-19 infections reach new heights. The United States sends its highest ranking envoy to Taiwan in decades as China conducts naval exercises in nearby waters. Later in the show, a highlight from Monocle's Chiefs Conference in St. Moritz.
If you're a global brand the way we are, is that we're trying to deal with a very global range of perspectives. And we're trying to make decisions that make sense to people who are living more so than ever in completely different realities.
Plus, our weekly reflection on what we've learned since this time last Friday. All that coming up right here on The Briefing on Monocle 24. And welcome to today's edition of The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller. This week, recorded cases of COVID-19 in Europe cleared 300,000 for the first time. This may be at least as reflective of more and better testing than any actual acceleration of the pandemic, but it is still clearly not good news. The WHO's Europe Director Hans Kluge has warned that this should serve as a wake-up call as governments continue to try reminding their citizens that there are worse things to be sick of than lockdowns, quarantines, curfews, and this whole thing generally. I'm joined with more on this by Dr. Chris Smith, Monocle 24's health and science correspondent, also a virologist at Cambridge University. Chris, I guess first of all to that question of what the 300,000 means, is it likely that more people are actually infected than ever before, or just that we know more about the ones who are?
Both are true, Andrew. The reason being that we've had bigger testing capacity across the European nations for quite a while, and so therefore any effect of enhanced testing and enhanced follow-up from tracing would already be intrinsic to the numbers, and those numbers have risen, and therefore there must be a contribution from more cases in general as well as just more detections. And this is borne out by the fact that if we look at the rates of positivity in tests for the laboratories showing their data that I've seen, for example, the fraction of tests that they're doing that are positive for coronavirus, at least in the UK, have increased. They were down at single numbers of percent, like about 1%. There's an uptick to about 3% in some laboratories. But by far and away, the greatest number of diagnoses we are still making and accounting therefore for the symptoms that people are showing at the moment are common cold type viruses, which are very common at this time of year.
Well, that obviously does prompt a reminder of the fact that winter is looming and Europe has not dealt with COVID-19 properly in winter yet. It sort of arrived here at the tail end of last winter, February, March and so forth. How nervous do you think authorities and health bodies are getting about the approach of winter?
Very. And we've been saying for a long time that actually handling the false alarms is going to be as much of a headache as handling the coronavirus cases, because the problem is we know at this time of year these sorts of seasonal disorders are very common. The common cold, there are hundreds of different viruses that cause common cold type symptoms, and they overlap very heavily with the case definition of the new coronavirus, a fever, a cough, a loss of sense of smell and taste. Those are what we're using as our defining features to trigger a test. So anyone with some or all of those features is saying, well, I need a test. And the problem is that the far and away most common cause of those symptoms are not coronaviruses, they're other things. And they are extremely common. The average person gets between 3 and 5 cold-type illnesses in winter. And that is what is currently breaking the back of the testing process, because people with those symptoms are quite rightly seeking a test and they can't get it.
Nevertheless, Hans Kluge was keen to emphasise the importance of the 14-day quarantine. Can you just remind us of why 14 days has become important for people arriving from or to certain countries or people who have symptoms for it, and why the 14 days hasn't shifted or appeared to be negotiable at all?
When all this began, one of the first things that people began to document, because it's very important for understanding the dynamics and predicting the behaviour of a disease, is what's its incubation period. And large numbers of cases were reported, documented and followed up to work out what that incubation period is. The shortest documented incubation period appeared to be about 1 day, the longest about 11 days. And so if you settle on 14 days, it gives you wiggle room for people misremembering when exactly they might have been tested, misremembering when they're exposed, etc. So we use 14 days as the outside limit from a time at which a person was exposed to a time within which they should present with the disease. It is quite a long incubation period, unfortunately, and that means that the only way you can be sure that a person is not going to get it is to quarantine a person after the last time of potential exposure for that 14-day period, and if they continue to have no symptoms or test negative or both beyond that time, they have not caught coronavirus at up until the point at which they began to quarantine.
What's your sense then of how close we might be to a tipping point across Europe generally, at which regional and possibly even national lockdowns start to become likely again?
Well, it just depends on how pusillanimous everyone wants to be. Increasingly, people are beginning to have the conversation now, which a lot of people have been having behind closed doors but didn't really dare to talk about, which is the how much of this are we willing to tolerate in terms of burden in society? How much spread, how much burden of disease are we willing to accept and trade off against normality? And previously, people thought, let's have a really very good go at suppressing this thing. We'll use tactics which are blunderbuss tactics because we don't understand the foe we're trying to defeat at this stage. We'll use very powerful tactics like lockdowns to suppress this thing down very hard and see where it gets us. Where it's got us is to a position where we've bought time, but we remain a highly susceptible population. This is a very infectious agent. But what we've learned in that 6 months of lockdown is actually who it preys on, who it picks on. It's not an equal opportunities virus. I've said this many times. It disproportionately preys on older people, people with pre-existing health conditions, people who are male. And because we know who those people are, it's beginning to shift people's thinking towards, well, we know what the risk profile for those people is. We know that the risk profile for people who are outside that upper age category is, and it's very low. Therefore, are we still following the right pursuit? Are we going in the right direction if we again say we're going to condemn an entire population of a continent to a lockdown at huge economic cost and educational cost and psychological cost for a group of individuals that we know who they are? We could actually spend probably less resources and really put that effort into protecting those people to the greatest extent that we can, while affording everybody else the same freedoms that they've currently got. And it's beginning to come round to maybe just locking things down is kicking the can down the virological road, and it doesn't actually do anything other than cost money, cost psychology, cost education, and ultimately that's going to have a cost attached to it in terms of lives lost, because if you decimate your educational system, you blunt a person's prospects in terms of jobs and therefore their social class. That we know has a strong health consequence. If you bankrupt a country, you can't afford healthcare, full stop. That has a health consequence. And if you make people depressed and psychologically unwell, that has a health cost as well. And we're now at a point where people are beginning to really, I think, justifiably ask the question, well, is the pill worse than the ill?
So is it possible then, and looking for something to be optimistic about as we head into winter, that if we do need to, I guess, to pursue your blunderbuss metaphor a bit, if we do need to engage in direct combat with this thing again, that we might be equipped with a slightly more subtle weapon this time?
Well, we do know a lot more. We have knowledge on our side. We understand more about how to manage the condition. We understand who to look out for. We have also got a lot more testing capacity. I know this has been very contentious in recent days, and part of that is because the system has been completely overwhelmed by the fact that, you know, people have gone back to school, people have gone back to work, they're on public transport, they've come back from holidays. There has been an uptick in transmissions, but the usual seasonal suspect viruses are causing symptoms in people, triggering people to seek testing. But if we put that to one side for a moment and say, well, we have got a lot of testing capacity now, we have got technology that can return rapid results for this. If we put those things together and we say, well, why don't we equip our caring community with access to very rapid testing and do our utmost to protect the vulnerable, and then we don't have to worry so much about other people in society because they're at really low risk. And that's the sort of conversation that's beginning to be had about to what extent we're willing to move these goalposts, because it is clear this virus is not going to go away. We are not going to have a vaccine by the end of the year. I talked to a vaccinologist earlier this week who's brought a lot of vaccines to market in his career, and he told me, based on his knowledge of the current state of the vaccine development progress and process for COVID, it's going to be June next year before we actually have a vaccine for this. That's a 9-month wait, and we just can't carry on the way we are for another 9 months. We are going to have to reevaluate our relationship with this virus.
Dr. Chris Smith, thank you as always for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing. Here is Yolene Goffin with the day's other headlines.
Thanks, Andrew. Two of the leading pharmaceutical companies in the race to create a coronavirus vaccine have made their blueprints public in a bid to win back public trust in how their trials are being evaluated. Moderna and Pfizer have shared details of their clinical trials, but have not confirmed timelines for when a drug would be widely available. The White House says 5 more countries are considering deals to normalize relations with Israel after the UAE and Bahrain signed accords earlier this week. White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows made the comments to reporters on board Air Force One, but did not name the countries, only saying 3 were in the Gulf region. And China has started combat drills near the Taiwan Strait today, just as a senior U.S. official opened high-level talks in Taipei. Beijing has said it would make a necessary response to the trip to protect its national sovereignty. China has become increasingly alarmed at Washington's warming relationship with Taipei, stepping up military exercises in response. Those are today's headlines. Back to you, Andrew.
Thanks, Yolene. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. Now, as we just heard, China's Navy is conducting live fire drills near the Taiwan Strait. There's little doubt about the intended audience, because in the slender credit where due file of US President Donald Trump remains his phone call shortly after his election to President Tsai Ing-wen of Taiwan, the first time that a US president, or indeed president-elect, had spoken to their Taiwanese counterpart since 1979. President Trump clearly understands that there is no more reliable way of winding up China than embracing Taiwan, which may be why he has now dispatched the highest-ranking American envoy in decades, Keith Krach, Undersecretary of State for Economic Growth, Energy and the environment, a rank which seems calibrated to annoy China even more by making any overt rage on their part appear somewhat silly. Well, I'm joined with more on this by Isabel Hilton, CEO of China Dialogue. Isabel, first of all, the visit of Keith Krach, and I've allowed time there for everybody to furiously Google, is that just trolling on America's part?
Up to a point, you left off, one element in the winding up list, which is that he's there to attend the memorial service for former president of Taiwan, Lee Teng-hui, who has counted as the most hated Taiwanese in Beijing, because Lee Teng-hui was the man who really led Taiwan to democracy and was also an advocate of Taiwan as a kind of independent cultural and political entity from China. So he's really not very, he's definitely not on the Christmas card list for Xi Jinping. And to pay tribute to him is a pretty, certainly would be read in Beijing as a further crime.
So what degree of seethe will Beijing be at over this visit?
Well, I think we're seeing it now. I mean, a great deal of rather sort of dangerous firepower is buzzing around at the moment. And we've seen really since June a kind of escalating provocation from China in sort of entering various kind of buffer zones, which have pretty much been respected for decades, you know, around Taiwan, that you can threaten and, you know, rattle a cage. But on the whole, it's been recognized that if you cross certain, you know, lines, then you are risking at least an accident. So, I mean, the problem was that, you know, in the last, well, just today, actually, 18 Chinese bombers and fighter jets entered Taiwan's air defense buffer zone. And that caused, of course, Taiwan to scramble its jets. So you had a lot of very, you know, serious ordnance flying around. And I think that, you know, is, and that along with the naval exercises and a great deal of rhetoric is probably as far as it will go. But, you know, we have seen a prolonged campaign for the last 3 or 4 years of diplomatic isolation, of kind of steady pressure on Taiwan from China. And certainly this doesn't help.
I mean, you correctly observed that the US envoy is there to attend the memorial service for a former Taiwanese president, but he will also be meeting with the current Taiwanese president. Is it likely that anything of actual substance is being discussed between the president of one country and the undersecretary of state for, you know, whatever, from the other one? Or is this, again, largely theatrical?
I wouldn't count on it being largely theatrical. If, you know, we have a kind of deepening confrontation between the US and China, and some alarming voices in Washington are advocating, for example, that the United States should supply nuclear weapons to Taiwan, which would be a pretty crazy move in my view. But there is a commitment from the United States to supply to Taiwan such a defensive military capability as is required. Now, it would be quite easy to argue that in a situation of enhanced tension, greater military supplies or more military supplies, perhaps more advanced military supplies were required, and I would expect that to be part of the conversation. I would also expect at least Tsai Ing-wen to be exploring the idea of more formal cooperation between Taiwan and the United States. The last U.S. official to visit, which was relatively recently, that produced an agreement of collaboration on health. I think Tsai Ing-wen would very much like to see a free trade agreement with the United States. So again, I think there's quite a lot to discuss, and I would be surprised if this visit took place without some of them being on the table.
Is anything really likely to shift in the near future, though, in any direction where this is concerned? Is everybody involved not basically biting their tongues and one hopes, metaphorically as well as literally, holding their fire until election day in the United States?
I'd certainly hope so. You know, the U.S. position on Taiwan, which is it's a treaty obligation to make sure that Taiwan can defend itself. This doesn't actually commit the United States to coming to the defense of Taiwan. But there is a kind of strategic ambiguity in this treaty, which is designed to stop Taiwan declaring independence and therefore provoking China, and to stop China assuming that were it to stage a military assault, the United States would stand by and not come to the defense of Taiwan. So the ambiguity in the U.S. position is designed to keep both sides calm. Under a Trump administration, of course, calm is not a highly valued factor in Washington's calculations, but I think that the hope would be in Washington that enough kind of chest bearing and beating will just keep everybody from doing anything too rash. I certainly don't think that China would relish an armed conflict. But on the other hand, if the United States and or Taiwan are seen as too provocative in Beijing, in order to satisfy its increasingly nationalist domestic opinion and a PLA that seems fairly restive at the moment, they might feel obliged to do something. And as soon as you do something in a situation like this, then you're provoking something very, very dangerous indeed.
Isabel Hilton, thank you. As always, you're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. And now on The Briefing to Switzerland, where the Monocle team are just wrapping up our first live in-person event of 2020, the Monocle Chiefs Conference. From mayors of major European cities to the president of the International Red Cross, it was quite the all-star cast who graced the stage yesterday at Suvretta House in St. Moritz. One of those was the director of the world's leading art fair editions, Mark Spiegler. He gave us an insight into what this year's disruption has meant for Art Basel across the globe.
On the 19th of January, I left Hong Kong, having spent a week there to explore whether or not the political unrest that had been unrolling for at least 6 months was going to derail our fair, was going to be so disruptive that it didn't make sense. And I left incredibly optimistic because I had the sense that things were calmer, that the city was very much behind us, that the region was very much behind us, and we had the data to prove it. And within the space of 2 weeks, COVID-19 had caused us to cancel the fair in Hong Kong, which would have taken place only 5 weeks later. And at the time, from a leadership process, it's very interesting because you're dealing with a constantly changing set of circumstances, information. You know, first you realize that schools are shut down, but they're keeping the convention center open, and that, you know, then you realize that you're not sure if you can get the walls into the harbor because medical and food supplies are being given priority. Then you realize that certain countries are shutting down all flights to Hong Kong. You know, so one day after another, it just became logistically more and more impossible. And, you know, the whole art world is looking at you and saying, why are you doing this? Why haven't you canceled yet? And yet others are looking at you and saying, how can you cancel this fair? It's so important. You're going to put galleries out of business. Artists will go into poverty. You know, it's irresponsible to think about canceling this. And I think there's this, you know, you can't win. But we dragged out the process to the point where it became clear that there was no other option. And for some people, it seemed eternal. The whole thing was a couple of weeks. And then, you know, we did that. And then foolishly enough, I came up here on vacation mid-February thinking, okay, this is behind us. We've survived this ordeal. And then, of course, by early March, you know, the virus was sweeping into Europe. And I went to New York in for the Armory show in early March, and already Northern Italy was starting to shut down. And in New York, I don't know if any of you were there in early March, everybody was sort of, oh, look, it's the funny handshake time. Do we do this? Do we do that? And I said, no, this is going to be a much bigger thing than you realize. And no one took it very seriously. I told everyone they should bow out of respect and against the anti-Asian sentiment that was going on at the time. But by the time I left a week later, New York had declared a state of emergency around the virus. And of course, we all know what happened in New York and the United States. But still, you know, at the time that I left, we were still planning to do Art Basel in June, as we always have. 2 weeks later, you know, with travel between the United States and Europe having been shut down unilaterally by Donald Trump, and other issues arising within Europe, we postponed to September, and we said, okay, by then it should be okay. Maybe the warm weather will make things better. Obviously, that didn't play out. But we postponed to September, and again, we had the same sort of arc of, you know, waiting and seeing and watching things develop and hearing quite a loud set of voices from our region. And again, you know, when we were coming up to early June and the question was, should you move forward with September or not, there were the people from America thought we were completely insane to even think about it. And yet I had people from Germany saying, we must go on, we must battle on, we must do this. Because of course, you know, where you stand depends on where you sit. If you're sitting here in this room with no one wearing masks and no one having to wear masks, it's a very different thing than if you're living in New York or other states where it's considered socially offensive to be outside without a mask, you know? And I think that's sort of the difficulty of the situation. If you're a global brand the way we are, is that we're trying to deal with a very global range of perspectives, and we're trying to make decisions that make sense to people who are living more so than ever in completely different realities.
That was Mark Spiegler. We'll have many more highlights from the Chiefs Conference across the day, and we have a live special of the Chiefs incoming. Do stay tuned for that. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. This is The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller. Finally today, our weekly reflection on the extent to which the last 7 days have improved our understanding of anything. We learned this week of an impressive new honour awarded to US President Benito Cartman.
And as you know, a little while ago, I received the Bay of Pigs Award from the Cuban Americans in Miami. And that's a big honour, and they don't give it out easily.
We further learned that indeed they don't give it out easily, or indeed at all, as no such award exists. We also learned that it isn't the Cuban Americans in Miami entire who don't present it. In 2016, then-candidate Donald Trump visited the Bay of Pigs Museum in Miami, which commemorates the calamitous 1961 CIA-backed attempted invasion of Cuba, and met veterans of the operation, who gave him a little painted shield. So we learned that an exciting new world of opportunity for self-aggrandizement has opened up for any of us who've ever been presented with any trinket while discharging our professional duties. Certainly the white tote bag embossed with the silver crest of San Marino, which we've mostly been using for the shopping, feels a lot more exciting if thought of as the decoration attendant upon being ennobled as a Grand Knight of the Serene Order of the Emerald Elephant, or whatever. If you'd listen to the rest of this while bowing frantically and averting your eyes, as befits our status, we'd be much obliged. Here in the UK, we learned, or at least attempted to make sense of, the latest official attempts to curb the spread of COVID-19. We are now, it says here, operating under something called the Rule of Six, a number about which there aren't that many songs which will serve as an appropriate soundtrack, which is why we're playing this one, but we would like to reassure those listeners already sprinting for the sandbags, ear defenders clasped to head, that we will not be attempting any handbrake punchline about COVID-19 and The Cure, because we're better than that. The Rule of Six means that we cannot associate socially with more than that number of people, though who has that many friends, and also that the entire country is making the same joke about the Prime Minister trying to avoid at least some of his children. It wasn't that funny the first 3 million times, but thank you. We did learn, however, that there is at least one exception to the Rule of Six, mandated by a government which, whatever its other flaws, is unafraid to embrace self-parody. We learned that gatherings of up to 30 people will be permitted so long as all involved are armed with shotguns and intent on terrorising grouse.
Wait till they hear my old shotgun blast! Shotgun boogie!
We also learned, in fairness, that this was part of a much wider exemption for many sporting activities, but this was the one that got all the coverage. So we also learned something about how, still, absolutely nothing winds up the English like an appeal to class resentment. Sort of speaking of which... We learned that Queen Elizabeth II is to become marginally less royal, and also that The Models' 1985 number 2 Australian hit Barbados is going to get a run behind this monologue for the second time in recent months. And who'd have seen that coming? 2020, eh? For we learned that Barbados has decided that Her Majesty is surplus to their current requirements, and that the Caribbean island will become a republic from next year. Barbados is the first country since Mauritius in 1992 to cast the British crown aside, and a potentially resonant toppling domino. Of the remaining 14 non-UK countries of which Britain's monarch is head of state, fully 8 are in the Caribbean vicinity. A complete Caribbean exodus would reduce the overseas realm to Australia, Canada, Papua New Guinea, the Solomon Islands, Tuvalu, and New Zealand, which we have arranged in that order deliberately to inflame Kiwi paranoia that it might be according to descending importance. No offence, Tuvalu. And we learned of an absolutely entrancing political scandal in Kyrgyzstan. Dastan Jubamakov, the Speaker of Parliament, appears to have bunged the equivalent of $600 to a woman after she named her new baby after him. We then learned, because we looked it up, because the concept of the tawdry seeking of petty affirmation by desperate politicians has been on our minds ever since this monologue's opening item, that times have been hard in the United States for one particular boy's name these last few years. It was already struggling as the 441st most popular choice as recently as 2015, but has since further slumped to 553rd, only one place, and we're not making this up, above Keith. It is inevitably Donald, but Bay of Pigs award or not, would $600 be enough? A semi-related plug for tomorrow's edition of The Foreign Desk. It's the third in our four-part series looking ahead to the presidential election in November. Part one was about the Democrats. No, it wasn't. It was about the Republicans. Part two was about the Democrats. Part three, which airs tomorrow at midday UK time, looks at the conspiracy theory QAnon and the effect it may yet have on the election. That is all for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Marcus Hippie and Jolene Goffan. Our studio manager was Louis Allen. The Briefing returns on Monday at the same time, midday London. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.